It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Advances in forensic science, such as DNA testing, have led to the reopening and solving of cold cases. A prime example is the 1979 murder of Catherine Janet Walsh, who was discovered strangled in her Monaca home. Over three decades later, DNA evidence would lead to former Bridgewater Councilman Gregory Scott Hopkins being charged with criminal homicide. His trial began last week. But once a suspect is caught, it leads to a new set of challenges when the case does go to trial. Pitt Law Professor David Harris joins us now in Studio A to discuss the unique problems in trying cold cases. David Harris, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks very much. It's good to be with you again.
And if you have a comment or question for our guest, you can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Our email address is essspgh@wesa.fm. And you can reach us on Twitter at essspgh and follow the conversation at #EPLive. David, let's begin with the basics. What is a cold case?
A cold case is simply a case where in the investigation may have been thorough, but it did not lead to a particular individual that the police could find, or maybe it led to somebody, but there simply wasn't enough evidence to make an arrest. After a certain period of time, the police have chased down all the available leads, gone through every available test and possibility, and manpower has to be redeployed often to newer cases that roll in. And after some time, we begin referring to these cases as cold because the trail has gone cold, the case is set for a while, and that's pretty much what happens.
Do you suppose, and this is something that just occurred to me now, but do you suppose in a case like the one that I referenced from 1979, that somebody thought after it went cold, there may be some way in the future to pick this up? What prevents the police and the investigators from discarding some of the strands of an investigation that that they might otherwise do if they are discouraged?
Well, police do sometimes discard pieces of an investigation after the case is cold. This is actually a fairly common problem for police in cold case units. I had a occasion to talk to a number of my law enforcement contacts about this whole set of problems, and one of the things they run into all the time is the fact that sometimes you have a case that's cold and it's been in the drawer for 15 years or 20 years or 10 years, and witnesses have moved away, files have been disposed of, evidence has been disposed of. That makes investigating a case that has been sitting a long time much more difficult than cases in which those pieces of evidence and statements and so forth have been preserved. So it happens usually without anybody's trying to do it. Sometimes it'll just occur when regular protocols are followed for throwing out old stuff.
What are some of the other potential difficulties of solving and trying cold cases?
Well, probably the most difficult thing is that witnesses die, they move away, they become unavailable for one reason or another, so you can't maybe get to the witnesses. Then if you can get to the witnesses, oftentimes memory fades. Let's face it, we don't remember things 30 years ago the same way we do things that happened last week. And so in the Walsh case, there's been some great reporting on this, that some of the witnesses just haven't been able to recall the details of this night and the day after when the young woman's body was discovered.
Right.
It's just been too long.
Well, for example, they were asking the woman who was with her at a Perkins restaurant late at night, what did she eat? How would you remember that after
30, I'm not sure I can remember what I ate yesterday, honestly.
Right.
For this lady to remember what she ate on some night that was otherwise unremarkable decades ago is really difficult. A few people could do that. Now, the case itself won't always turn on being able to remember every detail, but there are going to be some important details that have to be recalled. And that's a real difficulty with these kinds of cases. So even if you can find the witnesses and find the evidence, sometimes human memory is a big, big problem.
And are there special problems for police who investigate cold cases besides the ones that we've mentioned?
Oh, yes. Evidence, as I said, can be lost. It can deteriorate. For instance, if it's a type of evidence that needs to be refrigerated, let's say, maybe that wasn't done. And you have certain kinds of evidence that was not testable or not testable in the same way when the case was originally hot. And now we have better DNA technology, for instance. And if they had the samples, they would be able to test them now. We also have more people in the DNA databases on which a sample could hit. So that's one set of problems. The evidence has often not been tested with the most modern or newest technology. But a whole other thing is that sometimes when cold case units are set up, police officers in these units, I was told, will sometimes make the mistake of gravitating toward the cases that are to them the most interesting or the most notorious. And I heard this from several officers. They said the right way to do this was to go through all of the cold cases and prioritize them, not on the basis of did it affect you or was that your case or was that notorious, but which case has the file still there? In which case was evidence preserved? In which case could we still get access to witnesses? And the more of those boxes you can check, the more likely you are to be successful getting an old case back on its feet and to come to a solution that could crack the case. So there's a right way and a wrong way to do this.
But then should police officers, if they can't check off the boxes, as you say, should they be discouraged from going after some of these cases that maybe don't have a good lead, but that someone just wants to try hard to solve?
Well, I would never encourage somebody to drop something that needs a solution. But let's face it, this is a question of resources and priorities. All police departments now are under tremendous fiscal and manpower pressure. And so if you're going to set up a cold case unit, you want to use it in the way that is most likely to produce the best results most of the time. It's a simple question of priorities and resources. So somebody, there may be a victim or victim's family member in a case that really wants it solved. And I don't discourage anybody from trying, but honestly, you have to put your effort and your time and your manpower where it will best serve the purpose. And sometimes the answer, as tough as it is to hear this, must be, look, there's just nothing for us to do in this case. We don't have any new evidence. There's no DNA to test with a new test. There's no witness that's come forward. Therefore, we're kind of stuck where we are.
We're talking with Pitt Law Professor David Harris about cold cases. If you have a comment or question, 412-246-2002 is the number to call. Again, 412-246-2002. Let's go to the phones. We have Chris in Moon with a question. Chris, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. I had a quick question and a quick comment. The question is, given that the DNA technology has advanced so far and may advance further, Professor Harris knows, I mean, can DNA be transmitted through touchscreen devices such as tablets over a network? That's the question. And the comment is, it seems like most of the benefit from advances in DNA, or many of the benefits, as I'm sure he knows from the I can't remember the name of the project.
I'll tell you what, Chris, I'm going to stop you there. But let's answer that first question you had, and then we'll let you answer the second one. But interesting question about DNA being transmitted on a touch screen. I'm assuming you mean just from the screen itself.
Well, given that everybody's input device now is their finger.
Yeah,
I mean that's leaving an oil that's full of DNA, so.
Or on a key, or as part of a tablet on a screen, or
well, in practice, it has become possible to test smaller and smaller amounts of DNA to test them more accurately, and actually to untangle mixtures of DNA that appear in various places. And you will find people involved in DNA testing and analysis talking about touch DNA. And I think this is probably what you're referring to. They're able to test some of these very, very small samples that just come from somebody touching a surface or an object. So things that wouldn't have been testable some years back, like a touch screen, might be testable now and even more so in the future.
And you're sampling maybe some liquid it's if the person's hands were sweating or, you know, oils or that kind of thing?
Yes, anything that contains the person's biological fingerprint, to use the common term, anything that contains a bodily fluid.
Okay, Chris, and the second part of your question?
Yeah, they're very interesting. The second part is this. I mean, the main beneficiaries of DNA technology or the opening of cold cases seems to have been people who were railroaded 30 years ago. What is the professor's comment on that?
Certainly there has been great benefit to some number, over 300 people who have been proven innocent after conviction by DNA testing. In some cases, DNA testing was not really in existence or use when their convictions came about. In other cases, it was, but other much less accurate technologies were used, and in some cases, you had just confessions that were supporting the conviction, and DNA testing was not done, maybe because it couldn't have been at the time. But we have other beneficiaries as well. We have to remember that when we test a sample and we run it against a database and we get a cold hit, that is essentially a huge benefit there. We don't hear about it very much, but we get a huge benefit because we get the person who is very likely to have committed the earlier offense. And if that person is, say, a sexual predator, a person who is likely to reoffend a lot, we will save future victims from suffering that same fate. So we hear a lot about the innocence cases and that they are important, but we need to also remember that we're getting predators off the street when we do this, assuming we do it right and assuming that the databases are collected and stored in the right way.
Chris, thank you for that call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Tim in Morningside, who has a great question. Tim, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. You're on with David Harris.
Good afternoon, David Harris.
Good afternoon.
David, is there any form of statute of limitations on cold cases or anything? I was watching a special on Channel 13 last night about Scotland Yard. And they had cases in, you know, especially the Jack the Ripper one. It goes back so far. I'm just curious, is there a point where they say, you know, we shouldn't pursue this any further?
Well, that's a great question. There are two questions really rolled into one. Is there a point where the police just say there's no point in pursuing this any longer? And that's strictly a question of how difficult it might be to solve it and where you want to put your resources. But the statute of limitations question is actually different. Different crimes have different statutes of limitations. Those are laws that say past a certain point, you simply cannot prosecute a case. And all crimes have statutes of limitations, but the more serious the crime, usually the longer the statute of limitations will be. So in many jurisdictions, you find the very serious crimes like rape or murder having very long or even no statutes of limitations. So if there's no statute of limitations, you don't have to worry about it. But where there are statutes of limitations, you have to make a charge within the time given by the law. You have to bring a charge against somebody to stop the statute from running. And what has been done in a few very interesting cases is without knowing the name, the identity of the person, but having the person's DNA sample, they have charged John Doe with the crime and said, this is John Doe, and used the DNA identification in lieu of, say, name, date of birth, and so forth. And so far, in some states, that has held up as a way to stop the statute of limitations from running out. Very interesting.
And will those laws change because of the technology available today?
I think some of them will, because the better we're able to do with some of this science, it would be foolish of us not to respond to it. I've had a chance to discuss on this program my own book about how law enforcement doesn't always respond well to science, but this is an area where, if we don't respond to it, shame on us, because if we've got technology that will take our ability to solve crimes out decades, and who knows what else might be ahead in future years, we've got to adjust our laws so that our science can give us the full benefit.
And in the case of the previous caller referenced Jack the Ripper, now that goes back to 1888, but if there's DNA available, you could even today, presumably?
Assuming that it's preserved correctly in a testable form, there's no reason that you could not test it. The problem will be that the person whose DNA it is long gone, almost certainly. They'd be very, very old by now. So nailing down who did that, even if you had the DNA sample from the crime scene, it's not clear you could match it to anybody very easily, or even say, well, this person who lives today, one of their ancestors was doing this. Mm. And that would be a pretty difficult thing to do anyway.
Right. But I guess in a case like Jack the Ripper or something more closer to today, like the Kennedy assassination, which is a cold case, and for some consider it a cold case, if evidence emerged that indicated it was not Lee Harvey Oswald, or at least not Lee Harvey Oswald acting alone, you'd want to pursue that even if there was no way to involve an assassin who's long since disappeared or passed away.
No, you're making a good point that it still would pay to know the truth. There's
right.
no doubt about that. But we don't want to raise expectations too high by thinking that just because – let's assume we could find a DNA sample on something involved in the crime, a gun, a bullet, something like that. We wouldn't necessarily be able to match it to anyone else, living or dead.
Right.
It might tell us, well, there could have been somebody else involved. It wouldn't necessarily give us a definitive answer, though.
And speaking of raising people's hopes, have police procedural dramas and reality shows given people false hope when it comes to solving these cold cases?
Oh, I think there's no doubt about that. And police will tell you that this is true across the board, not only with DNA technology, but with lots of forensic technology. Folks who later serve on juries watch shows like CSI or NCIS, and they think, well, gee, any test, some test is going to solve the crime. And they want to know in all these cases, why didn't you test for DNA? Why didn't you run DNA? Well, DNA actually only shows up in something like 5% of all cases. And in some percentage of those 5%, it's not really necessary because we know who was involved. The question is what happened, not who. And so DNA, scientific testing, these things are great, great benefits to us in terms of criminal justice. But the television shows have tended to oversell them to potential jurors. And then when we get onto juries, we tend to expect far too much out of the police and forensics world.
We have just a couple minutes left with Pitt Law Professor David Harris. I wanted to go back to the Catherine Janet Walsh case. There was plenty of evidence in that case. It was just a matter of the technology catching up to it. And it took nearly 34 years for that to happen. How has this evidence made it possible for these cases to go to trial?
Well, in this case, there was not enough evidence, as I understand it, when the case had when the murder was committed to bring charges. Fast forward 34 years, there are now tests that you can use on the DNA samples that were recovered when the case was cold, because DNA just wasn't on the horizon originally. And now they test the DNA, they find out it belongs to a particular individual who's the defendant in that case, and that puts him at the scene of the crime. Now, what's still uncertain is he says they had a relationship and they had sex in that same place, and that would explain the presence of his DNA on the various items found in the victim's bedroom. So even there, DNA is not always going to slam the door. It just shows he was there. It doesn't say when or what the circumstances were.
And in this case, the same DNA evidence that got the case to be considered for trial started to slow it down because they had to parse through what they had and decide apparently what was admissible. Can you explain what happened there?
Well, not every DNA sample and not every DNA test is going to end up being admissible. Sometimes you have new methods or small samples or things like that. But I think what you're thinking about here is that there was some question whether it should even come in because it is such powerful evidence in terms of showing somebody's presence at the scene of a crime. My friends who were involved in this science joke that DNA stands for do not acquit. Mm. And perhaps there's a danger that a jury could be misled into thinking, boy, this is great evidence and strong evidence that the guy's guilty. Well, he says, yes, I was there. I was there on different occasions. And we had this sexual activity that would explain the presence of my body fluid, but it wasn't on the night in question. And so the DNA doesn't fully connect the dots here. You're relying on much more traditional kinds of evidence, and that had to be sorted through.
Pitt Law Professor David Harris joining us. As always, a pleasure talking about all these aspects of the law with you.
My pleasure, Paul. Thank you for having me.
Coming up, advice on how to survive a toxic workplace environment. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.